very dangerous woman.
Anything that you can do, I can do it better while I'm bleeding. Every dollar that you make, I make a percentage, call it even.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin, and welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show with me, someone who is so absolutely not Maggie Dawn, despite the name of the show. I am Anastasia Esther, sometimes called Anya Esther, sometimes called Hey You, but always called the producer of this show, and today also the host of this show, coming to you live in Maggie's absence to talk to you about a number of things. First of all, am I the only one just now learning that we found a baby alligator in Lake Michigan? Was I expected to learn that on my own just now from the news bit before this show? What do you mean? How did he get there? Where did he come from? I'm worried about him. That's just huge news to me. What? I don't understand what is happening in Lake Michigan. Has it not been in the same past 3 months that we've also had, what was he called, a mandarin duck? Some sort of duck who wasn't meant to be here. He's from, like, the other side of the world, essentially. And also some flamingos. What are they putting in the water of Lake Michigan? Is it salt water suddenly? The climate is very clearly changing, folks. And while I appreciate the interesting flora and fauna that comes with it, I'm a little bit concerned about the long-lasting effects. Other than that, we're going to talk about today something that is near and dear to my heart. You might not expect it because I am who I am. I'm just a radio producer. But previous to being a radio producer, I worked almost exclusively in childcare in different forms. I also picked up odd jobs as a bartender, and I was a plane de-icer for 2 weeks. That was an interesting stint. But I was always working at least one job, if not two or three, and one of those jobs was almost always through high school and through college, some form of childcare. So I want to talk to you about the bill that the Biden administration has been working on regarding changing how childcare works in this country. Essentially, the executive order that was put forward in April was signed, and it directed the Department of Health and Human Services to consider policies to reduce childcare costs for families and improve payment policies for childcare providers. So what does that mean? It means we want to see families be able to get really good childcare for their kids without it costing the entirety of both parents' paycheck. Which, quite frankly, as someone who worked in childcare and saw the back end of these things, childcare is so expensive. We'll get into some of the costs of different childcare programs I was a part of later on. But to discuss the specifics of the Biden bill, Vice President Harris announced at that time that alongside lowering the cost of childcare, they were going to focus on strengthening something called the Child Care and Development Block Grant, or the CCDBG. All letters that rhyme. Perfect. Definitely won't be confusing for later on in the show. But the point of this grant, or the point of this funding, was to help ensure that working families aren't paying more than 7% of their income towards child care, and any families who are below the federal poverty level, at or below 150% of the federal poverty level, they're actually going to pay next to nothing. They're going to encourage states to waive co-pays for those families because, of course, money is already so tight and those children absolutely need care because where are their parents? Their parents are at work not getting paid enough. Almost almost no matter where it is that they're working or whatever field it is that they're in, right? So this is a good start, I think. I think this is a phenomenal start, and it started back in April, so we're going to see more people talking about this soon. We're going to see more developments on this, and that's wonderful. But I'd like to add to this that for as much as childcare is financial and as much as our struggles with childcare could be remedied by there being more money put into it, or better, that the pricing for such things is reined in a little bit, right? When one can't donate any more money, one hopes that the price simply gets lowered. That's two ways of fixing the same problem, right? But in addition to money, I think we have to talk about where are we at as a culture, as a society, as a group of people who live next to each other when it comes to the care of kids and where kids and their caretakers get to be and how much space they get to take up. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to walk you through my basically my nine and a half years of education work, which almost doesn't make sense. But again, it's not all professional work. It's not all postgraduate work. I was raised a single child, so I wasn't raised taking care of younger siblings, but I got my babysitting license and did my babysitting training when I was about 12 or 13. And at that point, I started taking on neighborhood kids from as young as infants whose moms and dads or, you know, whatever set of guardians they had were already returning to work. And I was taking care of kids. Again, I was 13. I was taking care of kids who were like 10, which what 10-year-old respects a 13-year-old? They don't respect a 23-year-old or a 93-year-old who thought it was a good idea to put me in charge of these kids. But of course, it wasn't a good idea. Rather, I was very affordable as a babysitter, especially in comparison to what other childcare facilities cost at that time, and certainly what they cost now. And in addition to my services being hourly and quite affordable for these families, I would come to their home. I would fix meals in their home and clean things up, right? So that's a much better deal for someone. But I started working more professionally after that point when I got my work permit as a teenager and immediately went into tutoring. What I was told I would be doing when I applied for the job was, oh, we just have some kids who, you know, they're just not paying attention in class. That's how it was phrased to me. They're not paying attention. I'm like, okay, I can command attention just fine. I can be really loud. I can be really quiet. I can do funny voices. If I learned anything from babysitting very young infants, it's I know how to hold a crowd, right? Well, I get thrown into this first teaching job. Again, I'm like 14, 15. I'm a high school freshman in Wausau, Wisconsin, with no teaching training other than having been a student of teachers myself growing up to that point. And I walk into a classroom of roughly 25 students, all but one of whom are English as a second language learners. That was who I, a 15-year-old who applied for a tutoring job, was put in charge of. A room of kids who were already not being able to reach the grades they were expected to in the classroom. And again, phrased to me because they weren't listening. When in reality, many of them were only hearing English the 8 or so hours that they were at school. And because there was no additional support for them during the day, there was no other classroom for them to go to where things could be explained or re-explained or translated for them. Because larger amounts of money to get better prepared individuals into those well-prepared rooms didn't exist, they just kind of threw me at it. And I worry so much now about those 25 students I had. I kept this job for 3 more years through high school. So I had about 25 students a year. That's 75 kids I was in charge of when I was a minor. Their education put into my hands for whatever minimum wage was that year. Is it still $7.40? Is that what it was back in 2013, 2014-ish? I worry for them. I wonder what their grades look like now. I wonder how they're doing now. And if you are an educator, if you are a teacher, if you are a caregiver, I really want to hear from you today because I have thoughts on what could make childcare work in this country and in this state. I have thoughts on ways that we as a community, first of all, need to maybe talk about what it means to be a community a little bit more. But in addition, talk about once we are a community, what we can do and what sort of behaviors maybe we need to normalize more. Behaviors like not scowling at the mom whose baby is crying in public because how is that possibly her fault? Have you never met a baby? They just cry. The baby's not doing it to alert you as to how bad the mom is being necessarily. Could we maybe normalize a world in which kids and their caretakers are allowed to exist publicly? But also, can we normalize a world where we feel that each of us really is responsible for the care and keeping of the kids in our midst? Because there was a time where I remember hearing the phrase, it takes a village, and people would kind of nod along to it and understand that it meant kids take a lot of energy, of time, of patience, dear Lord, of patience, right? Because they're a lot, and schools become so overwhelming for professionals when the way that we're running schools right now is to take one underpaid, overworked, tired individual who cares so much and thrust them into a room of too many kids with no support and wonder why the teachers who are good at what they do are leaving, why the teachers who stay aren't doing as much as they used to, and why kids are reporting en masse in huge numbers, if we bother to listen to the kids, that is, why kids are reporting en masse that, you know, schools are becoming more threatening, more violent. They're feeling less support from their peers and from their teachers. Why? It's quite obvious. Everyone involved is very, very overworked and tired. That's not the kids' fault, it's not the parents' fault, and it's not the teacher's fault. I'll just throw that one out there. But maybe it has nothing to do with fault, and we need to start looking towards solutions in lieu of looking for whose problem it is. The song you heard at the opening is great, and you're going to hear a little bit more of it now. It's called Do It Like a Girl by Morgan St. John. You do not want to miss what we are going to talk about after this. Make sure you call in. Tell me your thoughts on education and childcare right now. Call in at 844-967-2789. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. The sultry sounds you are hearing about her disinterest in having, as she calls them, crotch goblins. Can you say that on air? That is the sultry sounds of Sarah Hester Ross and her song, No Babies. Now, this isn't a show. Today's show is not going to be about whether or not you want to have kids. Of course, we're going to talk about the ones that are already here, the ones that are in our education system. But I think it's a valid point to bring up. Less and less people are having kids. And I'll say this as a person who was in childcare for so long. Many, many days I would leave teaching. And my thought wouldn't be, man, I want to quit teaching. Not right up until the end. Then I started thinking that way. But many, many, many days I would leave and just think, oh my goodness, if I can't handle these guys, these little creatures, for the 2 hours a day that I see them, you know, after school when I was an after school teacher, how on earth would I ever handle having any of my own where I've got them for like 25 hours a day, 8 days a week? But now, having left education for a bit, I'm taking a bit of a deep breath and realizing that, you know what, the culture within education is so different from the culture of being a parent. Of course, I don't foresee a future where at any time I would have 30 kids at once the way that I did in a classroom. Lord help me, right? Octomom is one thing, but 30 mom would be something very different, right? But I think it's a fair point to bring up that many young people are observing how little help their parents had in raising them and how little help their peers who did have kids are getting, how much it affects their day-to-day life, how the spaces that existed for us as kids, like Chuck E. Cheese and Discovery Club and these things, kind of stopped existing when we were still in our preteens and teens. And I worry that the spaces that kids are allowed to be kids in outside of school in the home, which frankly, they're half the time not allowed to be kids there either, that these places are shrinking, and that's not a good thing for the upbringing of our kids. I'm going to come back to that point in a bit. But first, we have some folks on the line. First up, we have Mark from the SAC. Mark, what is on your mind today?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for this topic. I mean, I kind of think about it back to my school days, which are a long time ago now, and how dedicated my teachers were, mm-hmm. and that I still remember most of their names, you mm-hmm. know, through grade school, up till sixth grade, and then when you go to junior high, then that, yeah, you just have multiple teachers, but I can remember some of them as well, mm-hmm. that and the important lessons that they taught, and but they actually had support back then. I mean, that you know, my teachers in grade school, I can remember some of them had, you know, a teacher's aide or a student teacher, you know, coming into the class and observing how things happened, but there was a lot more support for and respect for the profession, I think, from our politicians back then than there is today, because, you know, frankly, we have, you know, we had Scott Walker, who, you know, took a axe to the school budgets in the state. We still have, you know, that the Republican Party that has left. I mean, that a good many of the ones in our leadership, you know, they did not go to public schools. They went to private religious schools, and which I think is a whole different environment. Mm-hmm. And going to one of those schools is no guarantee of a you know, well-behaved child coming out of it, because the girls that grew up across the street from, not the street, the road from us, because we grew up out in the country, mm-hmm. they all got sent off to Catholic school, and they all rebelled against their father and their mother, and got, you know, got into various forms of trouble, and so this nonsense they have that, well, if you go to school, there's prayer in school, you know, there's not going to be the problems. Well, number one, in public schools, you don't know what religion all the kids are in the class, because I can remember in my fifth grade class, there was a, you know, one of my schoolmates was, she was a Jehovah's Witness, and they mm-hmm. and she was excused from the moment when we said the Pledge of Allegiance, mm-hmm. because you could compel people to, you know, that because they don't believe in religious oaths like that.
Mark, I'm going to just cut you off there just because we've got other people on the line. I think those are all great points. And as the friend, a friend to many an ex-Catholic girl school attendee, I will tell you they are some of the best at rebelling. It's like they learned it in school almost. But I like the point that you brought up about respect. Now, I want to be clear. My views on respect have always been this. You know, respect is about acknowledging a person, allowing them to be in your space and to speak to them with kindness. When I talk about being respected as a teacher, I never expected, you know, to walk into the classroom and hear all of my kids stand up, "Good morning, teacher." You know, this was never a world that I expected. But to talk about respect to mean that that education is a noble profession, that it is something worth doing, that the people who do it, who make sacrifices in order to do it, you know, I'm not here to say any one profession deserves a badge of honor simply for taking the profession. I think there are many noble and honorable professions, but of course, people who are just, you know, not fit for that role could take that job. That doesn't make them a hero for taking it if, you know, they're not there to do what they're meant to do. In the case of a teacher, if someone who has an interest in, you know, making easy money, I don't know why they would ever think to go into education, but of course that person shouldn't be in there. But for the vast majority of educators who are truly, if for nothing else, there to teach, even if it is because teaching is what gets them a paycheck, more power to them. I don't see anything wrong with that. But when we attack and degrade and attempt to humiliate people who do that profession, it is truly no wonder why so many are leaving. Up next on the line, Gary from Sussex. Gary, go ahead.
Hi, Maggie. This is the second time. This is Anya,
but I am glad to hear from you, Gary.
Oh, Anya. Oh,
that's
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. I'm a conservative. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was in high school in the 60s. I got out of line. They grabbed me around the throat, scared the living daylights out of me, and I showed total respect to my teachers. The graduation rate back in those days was about 98%. Okay. Mm-hmm. My daughter is a teacher. She teaches. She never taught at MPS, but she did teach in a public school system. Mm-hmm. And she worked with, like, at-risk kids, okay? So the parents would make them go to this school. It was a private school. It was a religious school. But even though the kids didn't believe in God, they still had to go to school. Mm-hmm. My daughter loved these kids. She hugged them. She made teaching or learning fun, okay? So the thing is, you got to make, nowadays, they taught with fear, okay, back when I was in school. Now you have to, because the kids are different, you have to teach it, you got to make it so it's fun. I was a terrible student when I was in high school. My history teacher told me, I said, look, all I worry about what the future brings, I don't worry about the past. I don't need to worry about history. And she said, you know, someday your friends are going to be talking about something that happened in history. You're going to sit there and say, what was that? And they'll say, were you sleeping in history class?
This is a really good point, Gary. I hate to cut you off. We're going right towards a break. But I think you've got a good point in there that things are so different and we have to make education fun now. We're going to talk more about this just after this. Please enjoy once again, Sarah Hester Ross, No Babies.
I don't want to have no kids.
Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show with me, not Maggie, not Dawn. Rather, it's Anya, the producer. What you're hearing right now, or what you were just hearing, is a song, Child of the Government, by J. Lee Wolf. This song is about the residential schools in Canada. Residential schools also existed in the U.S., but this particular song is about the ones in Canada, a system wherein children of Indigenous Canadians, Native Canadians were taken and placed in schools, you know, claiming for their benefit. But of course, in this terminology, benefit meant removing them from their culture, from their people, being put in something that was, quite frankly, white and Christian, and therefore allowed to exist at that time. She has a really important line in here. My father's blood is mine. His story runs through me. And I think it's important to understand that when we talk about education today, we are discussing it with the survivors of versions of our educational system that were horrific and abusive. You know, Gary just called in. He gave his insight from his time in school and the insight of his daughter as well, who's currently a teacher. And I think his story highlights that we have now, at the very least, exited a time where it was appropriate or accepted for kids to be harmed in public or in public school. But there are other forms of harm happening when it comes to how much we aren't funding programs that we're putting our kids into, how little support is offered to the people who work those programs. Things as simple as just having extra sets of eyes. I was giving you kind of my short curriculum vitae previously. To round it out, I started babysitting at 12, 13, then went into tutoring You know, I received a paycheck. I have tax forms from that time. So that was my first professional job in teaching, where I was teaching a very crowded, overcrowded room of mainly English as a second language learners. Again, I was in high school. How was I ever possibly equipped to be the person who was put in charge of the education of those kids? Again, signed up to be a tutor. Tutor is very different, in my opinion, and also in the opinion of the job listing I read at the time. But additionally, moving through high school, you know, I was routinely tutoring my peers. Moving into college, alongside bartending and waitressing, I was working in after-school programs, caring for kids. I was writing curriculum for them. I worked in every different part of a summer camp, a day camp, as well as a sleepaway camp, you can imagine. And in addition, the last job that I held for a long time was I was a professional Jewish educator. I did after-school Jewish education. And looking back at the two types of careers I've had, my service industry career, the waitressing and bartending I did, there's only one job I quit out of all of those where I quit many of them, in honesty, but only one where I quit because I felt unsafe. I felt that if I continue to stay at, in that instance, this cafe, if I continued to stay there, I was already seeing unsafe practices regarding heating and, you know, I had bacon grease spilled on me. I was hurt pretty bad. That was my first day. And I was like, you know what? This place isn't safe enough, ready enough for me to work here, frankly. And I'm not going to put myself in harm's way. And that's fine and easy to say when it's just some cafe on the corner. If you want a BLT desperately, you'll walk to the next place that has one. But the same can't be said of childcare centers. And the same can't be said when we don't always know how safe things are. I'll say this. I left a number of my teaching jobs because I felt I was unsafe. And not maybe for the reasons you would expect. It wasn't because I was concerned about the ongoing violence occurring in schools regarding gun safety, although that was always on my mind. It was never, oh, I feel it's so imminent that I'm going to quit. Rather, I had incidents so many times where simply because of a lack of a number of teachers, there simply cannot be enough eyes to see kids. I spent a short period of time when COVID first reared its ugly head working in what was called a satellite school, meaning that this was a school for kids who had nowhere during the day to go. Their physical school had been closed for COVID. Their classes had been moved online, but their parents or guardians were not at home, or the home that they had, it was not safe for them to be there, or they didn't have Wi-Fi potentially. This was a place that kids with that background could come to, and my job in writing ahead of time was to simply facilitate making sure they got onto the Wi-Fi okay. Were they playing a game or were they listening to their teacher? What it very quickly became was a biohazard. And in addition to being a biohazard, for the 70 or 80 some students that we were placed in charge of, there were 4 or 5 undergraduate 20 something year old women. That's like 10 eyeballs total for 70, 80 some kids. I don't know how in control of your two eyes you are, but I can't do any of that chameleon stuff where I can point one way and point one the other to keep track of two groups of kids. Rather, my eyes can only look in one direction at a time, meaning I either need more people with more eyes or I need to work on my chameleon skills. And I think I know which one will probably happen which one is more likely to happen sooner. It's me taking a weekend and Googling how to dislocate my eyeballs, right? That same day that I started there, I said it was a biohazard. I'll get into that. But the first day I started at the school, remember I just said there's 5 of us and 70 some kids. I walk in to the building that was being used and I see a child who is standing outside a classroom. That's not a bad thing, but I just notice him. And I look away to speak to the person orientating me to the space. And when I look back, he was not where he was standing. And in my mind, I go, all right, I just got here. I don't know who that student is. There's a classroom right there. Surely he went right back inside. And I went to work taking care of my classroom, getting kids signed in. And what happened was, is that kid was able to get out of the building, all the way to the street, where he hailed a car. And he told that car his home address and asked them to take him home. That happened. I quit that job very shortly thereafter. Not because inherently I felt unsafe. I wasn't worried that the kid was going to go hitchhike and bring some stranger back to the school. Rather, I was not going to be left in a job situation wherein people, children I was in charge of, where there were so many children that I was in charge of, that there was no possible way for me to guarantee their safety. I simply, at that time, decided I would not allow myself to continue to be associated with that, because in the long term, there was no way that that was going to continue to be safe. And I was right. I didn't quit that very first day. I stuck with it. I try to always stick with things at least a little bit. But maybe a month later, again, this is early COVID, a child comes up to me and says outright, "Miss Esther?" And I say, "Yes." "Miss Esther, my mommy told me to not tell you that I got tested for COVID." And I went, "Oh?" She went, "Yeah, I got it." That was when I quit that job. Because I was being, as a teacher, sent into situations where kids were being sent into situations, being told to lie to me, because the satellite school I was working at was the last resort. And if the child was ill, and we knew they were ill, of course, they would not be allowed to come to the program that day. And if they could not come to the program that day, there was nowhere else for them to go. And I have deep, deep sympathy for each of the kids and each of the parents involved in that situation. COVID was a terrible time of terrible mismanagement that caused many, many people to lose their lives. Many had their lives uprooted. I don't have to teach you this. We all just lived through it, right? But there is something to be said about being the last line of defense against a world that simply is not making sense. And to have a handful of undergraduate students making at that time just above minimum wage, to manage way too big of classrooms with way too many exits, with way too many kids in them, trying to execute a plan put out by multiple different schools that none of them agreed on. And we wonder, why are our educators burnt out now? We've always known that educators were essential. We've always known they were needed. Are we going to know pretty soon how much we need to preserve the good ones? Or rather, are we going to know what it's like to live through a future where education in this country is not a priority, and live through the consequences of raising a society in that way? I should say too, this movement did not start with my age group. This fear that childcare was slipping through our fingers, that the time and energy and money it took to raise up a kid who felt confident and strong and intelligent took far more resources. There we go. Than two parents or two guardians could afford in an economy like this. Dear God forbid a single guardian in this time try to provide such a thing. But I will say we've made some very valiant strides. What I'm about to play for you is an ad from the 70s from Kentucky. I apologize if any of you recall this from your youth and if this brings about bad memories, but just to give an idea, these were the kinds of reminders parents had to be given when many of you were being raised, and frankly, we're kind of still working on undoing them.
Mommy, what's for supper?
Can't you see that I'm on the phone?
Hold it down, I just got home. Isn't it enough that I work all day?
At least you get a chance to get away. Dishes, diapers, dirty rags.
Bosses, bills, and nag-nag-nag.
Daddy.
Shut up, kids, you're in the way. I'm so mad I can slap your face.
Did I do something wrong?
Have you?
I'll let the rest of it play, but if you couldn't hear it, this is the depiction of what many of our students were coming home to in the 70s, and frankly, many of them still are. Mom, what's for dinner? Shut up, kid! That's a really, really hard way to be raised. And this was the message that the Kentucky Board of Health put out at that time in 75.
Hugged your kid today.
Did you hug your kid today?
Did you send him on his way? With love, love,
love, love, love. She's a person just like you. She's got feelings too, so give her love. Love, 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 love. If you hug him for a while, it'll leave you with a smile. He'll know it's love, 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 love.
She's a person just like you. She's got feelings too. Make those feelings love. These were the reminders from the same era of it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? And I'm glad we started encouraging at some point checking in on where your kids were. I fear that we're perhaps re-entering a stage where too many members of our communities who have kids don't have even the time to always check on where their kids are at emotionally, how they feel, things like this. Perhaps there is something we can do about that. Taking you to the break, once again, is Jay Lee Wolf, Child of the Government. We'll be back with more right after this.
Here's a child of the government.
Time here on the Maggie Dawn Show with me, someone who is so not Maggie Dawn. Instead, I am Anastasia Esther, coming to you live from Waukesha. And what you've just heard is World on Fire off of Dolly Parton's new album, her rock album, because of course Dolly Parton can do anything. Coming on to solo host this show happened at an odd time for me. If you didn't listen to my first couple of episodes, I ended up using a lot of them to discuss the events going on in the Middle East because my background, as I referenced earlier, I was a Jewish educator. So, of course, I am Jewishly educated. So when topics like this come up, I tend to run my mouth about them. Not going to do that tonight, but I would be remiss if I didn't end the show with some important history. Right about now, it's rounding the corner to 2 a.m. in Germany. So just about to the hour, we are observing the 85th anniversary of a huge pogrom that occurred during World War II in Germany known as Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass. This happened the night of November 9th, leading into the early morning of November 10th. Like I said, it's very early in the morning on the 10th for Germany right now. And this historic event, unfortunately for me, calls to mind a number of currently happening historical events. I won't sit here and try to play political connect the dot with you, but rather I'd like to tell you the story of Kristallnacht, including the details that quite often your high school history teacher didn't have time to cover. So I want to start here. Prior to Kristallnacht, Jews from throughout Europe were being gathered up, forced into ghettos and into boxcars and put throughout Europe, whether that was into concentration camps at that time or, like I said, into ghettos. And one such group that this happened to were Polish Jews who were living in France. And when a huge group of these Jews in France were picked up and taken out, they should have really been taken to Poland to just sort of, you know, go back to the towns that they had been living in previously. But instead, Poland wouldn't take them and France wouldn't take them back, and they weren't allowed to leave. So they're just sitting in this refugee camp. And two of the people in this refugee camp were the parents of a young man named, of course, now I can't find it, Jinspan. So Jinspan, hold on one second. A dog has just entered the studio. There we go. The dog is now out of the studio. So finishing this, Jinspan was a 17-year-old Jewish man who was living in France, who, when he heard that his parents had been essentially abducted by the Nazi government and taken and were now sitting in this refugee camp, he became very desperate to do something. And his decision was to go to the Nazi office, sort of the Nazi embassy. It wasn't an embassy, but their version of it. And he assassinated the first individual, the first Nazi who was assigned to him, who was Ernst von Rath. Now, why does von Rath and Jinspan matter? Well, they matter, of course, because they're two people and it's part of this story. But in the following days, of course, Nazi officials would hunt down and subsequently kill Jinspan, and he would die on today, 85 years ago. An important note about the 9th of November for the National Socialists was that this was already a huge holiday for them, already celebrating the 1923 Beer Hall Putsch, which was an attempt to overthrow the government orchestrated by Adolf Hitler himself. So to have someone assassinate a Nazi official and then subsequently die on a day that was already a big holiday for the Nazis was just all too well put together, that when Goebbels and a number of other officials got together on the 9th, the following was said by them. Of course, Goebbels was one of Hitler's speechwriters, and they reinvented the narrative around Jinspan and his assassination of Ernst von Rath as it being a world Jewry had together conspired to assassinate this individual. And that the Führer, this is a real quote, the Führer, Hitler, had decided that the response to this transgression, that the response should be a number of demonstrations, but these demonstrations should not be organized by the party, but insofar as they erupt spontaneously, and when they do, they are not to be hampered. Essentially, the Nazi government at the time outright said, look, we're not putting it together, but if you do, we won't stop you. And what occurred in the hours after, stretching into the evening and into tomorrow morning, 85 years ago, was an attack, a pogrom that left 91 people dead that night, as well as 30,000 Jewish men were rounded up and sent to concentration camps to be used for slave labor. And an additional statistic that does not get mentioned enough is, like I said, 91 people were murdered by Nazis that night. But additionally, in the weeks after, there were 638 suicides linked to the destruction of homes, property, and spiritual spaces on Kristallnacht. And that was the intent of these attacks from the beginning. Those who were involved, and you can find all of this on the U.S. National Holocaust Museum's webpage. This is where I pulled this info from, that members of the Hitler Youth were encouraged to wear civilian clothing so that inevitably when local newspapers did report on these things, they would have to report on it as just being random groups of young men doing this, as opposed to being some sort of organized event. I bring this up because to not bring it up on the anniversary felt wrong. And additionally, I will be live hosting again tomorrow. And to discuss what I've just told you regarding the number of people who lost their lives to suicide in the wake of Kristallnacht, tomorrow we are going to be discussing a number of changes to gun laws that are occurring throughout this country, including changes to gun laws for veterans who are experiencing mental health crises. And the ways in which, while I understand the conversation always comes back to personal liberty and personal freedom, we, of course, have to ask the question, are we making decisions that help people Or are we making decisions that open up ways for people to hurt themselves or others? And if we know the answer is one of those two, what is it that we're going to do about it? I hope you take some time to reflect on these things. Times are strange, times are tough, but we're going to get through it. Coming up after this is Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman, taking you to the end of my show today. Once again, is the indomitable Dolly Parton. This is World on Fire off of her latest album, her rock album, because yes, Dolly, of course.